ISO 400, Episode 125. Heute habe ich wieder einen ganz, ganz besonderen Gast dabei, Lukas Palka. Und zwar der Mann hinter Tokio Unseen, einem großartigen Buch. Erstmal das Intro, ab geht's. Hi, Lukas.
Hello.
Hi. It's incredible to have you here. The second guest in English. I already told you we're a German podcast, obviously. And with Alex, the last time I was changing lanes a little bit, and now I'm pretty excited to have you here in this little show and talk with you a little bit about your photography, about your approach in photography. And obviously about Tokio Unseen.
Well, I'm honored to be here. I'm honored to be one of the earliest English guests on your German podcast, which is pretty cool. Yeah. And I gotta say that intro music really hyped me up.
it's really good. It's incredible. We changed the intro recently, 5 weeks ago, four weeks, something like that. And I told my podcast buddy, Arthur, that I have to switch our intro because I found something pretty incredible. And since then, we are totally hyped.
I love it. I was bobbing my head when it came out. I was not expecting that.
Perfect. Sounds great. I'm glad you like it. How are you doing, man? Everything right in Tokyo? Everything's good?
Yeah. Everything's great. I'm doing great. Extremely busy with everything going on in my life, professionally and personally. But, you know, things are going well, so no complaints.
Perfect. Could you maybe give me a little bit, or our audience, a little bit insights about you? Who are you? What are you doing? Just a few words.
So I'm not going to, you know, do a long background history, but I come from Poland originally. Mm-hmm. And when I was a kid, we moved to the United States and I grew up there. And then I came to Japan in 2008. And I've been living here so almost like, going on 16 years now. And what I do here is I am a photographer. And then I under the umbrella of photography, I do a number of things. Of course, I work as a photographer doing like commercial work or sometimes even, personal headshots, you know, all kinds of stuff, a variety of things. Mm-hmm. But most of my time is actually spent on my business, which is called iExplorer, iExplorer. .com, the website. And we provide photography workshops. So that's a big, you know, focus of mine is this business where we teach photography on these little short, like up to 5 hour workshops. We call them workshops. They're different from what most people think of as workshops. They're more like photo tours, but they're very hands on and educational.
I wasn't aware of them. Incredible. Prepared myself for this show, for this podcast, and I was just flicking through Tokio Unseen in preparation for the podcast, but I wasn't aware of iExplorer. That sounds pretty interesting, and I would love to dig a little bit deeper. Is it more suitable for beginners, or do you have individual paths for beginners, pros, and stuff like that? What are you offering there?
So all of our workshops pretty much are either private completely. So it's like if you book it, it's going to be just you and your instructor, who will be me or one of the other guys on the team. There's like six of us total, including some very talented photographers who are very well known, at least in my opinion. Anyway, and then even the ones that are group sessions, like shared with other strangers, they're very small. It'll be like two or three people max. So it's very hands-on, very personalized. And the levels, it's anybody, you know, we obviously naturally get more beginners. I always say it's like a pyramid. You know, the base is composed of beginners. And as the, you know, skill level increases, there are fewer and fewer people in that skill level, because naturally there just are more beginners than, you know, experts out there. And also beginners are more likely to seek out educational experiences versus experts or pros who are like, well, I already know everything, so I don't need to learn anything. But you can always learn something. So we also have pretty serious professionals, or at least maybe not necessarily professionals, but like very serious high-level photographers who join our workshops. They usually come more from the approach of they want like kind of like a fixer. They want somebody to show them the cool locations because their time is limited.
Get you.
But in my experience, even those people will learn something because everybody, as a artist, can learn something from somebody else because this is a creative field, right? It's not a science where once you learn, you know, everything, you've learned everything. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. With creativity, you can always get a different perspective or another way of looking at things or a new understanding of something. And then if you're not from Tokyo and you come to Tokyo and then you work with a photographer who's lived here, you know, 15 years, and I'm not the only one on the team who's lived here a long time. In fact, the guy who's lived the longest, I think he's been here like 25 years. So, you know, if you meet someone who's been here shooting in Tokyo for 20 years, right, they're going to teach you something, no matter how good you are at photography or how. So it is really for everybody. And everybody has a good time regardless of level.
So it's also a quick behind the scenes. What are you doing? It's a mix. It's basically a mix. What are you offering? So it's a photo tour, a guided photo tour where you're going to show the highlights, the spots.
We kind of advertise it that way because that's what people sort of can understand and wrap their head around when they come to the website.
Yeah.
But really it's not about the spots. It's of course we take people around the cool neighborhoods that we think are interesting, but it's really about, seeing the city through the eyes of the instructor who you have on that day. They're going to teach you their shots or their way of, you know, photographing things. And, you know, sometimes the most interesting shots are not necessarily in any kind of highlight spot. It'll be like a random, like these days I'm doing this shot that I've discovered recently and like for myself. Mm-hmm. And I always start the workshop with this one. It's really weird. It's like a corner of a construction site. And there's like some plexiglass, you know, like plastic and it's reflecting a neon sign in a really cool way. And there's this cool abstract shot you can do there. So that's not like a famous spot or something beautiful. You know what I mean? It's something creative, but everybody seems to like it. They're like, oh, wow, I didn't think you could shoot this. I'm like, I know you didn't think you could shoot this. This is why I'm showing you. So that's kind of our approach. It's about expanding people's creative horizons.
Sounds pretty interesting because you are photographing a lot in the city and you know those spots. Obviously, not those attention spots, not those big ones, but those little small details, which are what are you experiencing when you are doing a lot of photography there, I guess. So you know those little small gems, I would like to say. Yeah, sounds great. Perfect.
Exactly.
Yeah, cool. Mm-hmm. Lucas, something about you as a person. What is your approach in photography? How did you approach or how photography approached you? Was it something you've done for quite a long time or developed it or did you develop it during your stay in Japan?
So when I arrived here back in 2008, I had a little bit of an interest in photography. I had a camera, like a little simple one. And I liked taking pictures. It was something I enjoyed. And I did it creatively. Like I tried to be creative with it, but I didn't do it very much. It was just sort of there in the background of my life, you know.
Okay.
And only after living in Tokyo for about a year and realizing that I'd been living here a year and I went back to like my normal routines that I always had, you know, go to work, go home. Watch a movie, go with friends, have a beer, you know. And I'm like, what am I doing? I'm in this amazing city, but I'm not really exploring it. So then I decided to buy a, you know, quote, I'm doing the air quotes, proper camera. I got a nice big SLR, you know, because that in 2008, that was the proper camera.
Yeah.
Right. And then that was my motivation. So I was like, okay, I'm going to take this camera. I'm going to actually go out. And I'm going to really walk around and take pictures. Right. And that's how it started. So it was just a way to get out of the house and explore the city. And of course I wanted to take nice pictures that I was pursuing a way to express myself through photography, but really I just wanted to like explore the city and like just have a good time, just kind of, you know, have an adventure by myself. Right. So that's how it started. And then it evolved into, you know, a job and more of a passion, like something I'm really, that's at this point defines kind of who I am. Like it's part of who I am. You know, without photography, I don't know who I am. It's part of my identity. Mm-hmm. Right. So, yeah, but that happened gradually over many years, of course.
But it was a, like you're telling me, it was an inner urge on your side to approach photography, right?
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah. It's just you know, I mean, I got to give credit also to my father, because he's into photography. And so he had a proper camera. And so I remember back in those days talking to him, and I don't know if he suggested or I asked him, but the point is, when I decided to get a camera, I got the same one he had, because I just thought, okay, I've held this camera in my hands when he like came to visit here in Japan, and I took some pictures with it. I was like, I'm just going to get the same one because it's cool. So the idea didn't come from nowhere. It kind of, I guess, came from my father. But then, yeah, the motivation came from Tokyo itself, just kind of like urging me to go explore it. And the camera was a tool for that.
Has it been street photography from the beginning, or did you approach different lanes in photography?
Yeah, so in the beginning, I never even heard the term street photography. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what that was. So, and then, but interestingly enough, I am more or less shooting the same stuff today that I was shooting in the beginning. Even though I've learned a lot and I understand much, of course, now what street photography is, although does anybody really understand what street photography is? Yeah. Right? It's this kind of vague sort of thing. But I have my own definition for it. Like I know what it is. But then I also recently, I did a video on YouTube called, that I titled Un-street photography. And the reason I came up with this term just for myself is because there is this kind of somewhat narrow definition of street photography that most people will agree on. And it's like, well, it has to be people, it has to be candid, right? It has to be with like a 35 millimeter lens or right? Not too close, not too far, you know, these kind of rules, which are honestly kind of arbitrary, but whatever. But I am often photographing like, you know, a pile of trash on the side of the road, cool looking pipes, a tree growing through like a window or something, you know, like all this kind of random stuff. Plus I do shoot like urban landscape. I do what many people would call urbex, where I go into like some abandoned buildings that I found around the city sometimes. So I just shoot Tokyo in any way that makes sense for whatever I'm encountering when I'm exploring the city. So if I encounter a cool abandoned building, well, I'm going to shoot it. I'm not going to just say, oh, I'm a street photographer, so I'm not even going to bother. That to me sounds stupid. So I just shoot everything. And so in terms of what like style or what, you know, things I shoot, I like to just call myself an urban photographer. I shoot the city, and that includes street photography, but that's only one facet of it. Although a big one. I mean, obviously I do a lot of street photography. That's a big part of what I do, but it's not the only thing. It's not the only thing.
But I think it's the main approach of what I'm seeing about your work in general. And that's pretty interesting. That's insane. And what I wanted to ask you, and I almost, and I forgot it in this second because I was flicking through Tokyo Unseen and was looking at all those beautiful pictures. But is your approach on street photography something like a project work that you're going that you're going out with a specific goal in mind? Or is it more like you're going out and getting into the flow and just photographing what comes into your viewfinder? Or is it more project related or something like that?
So it's definitely the second one that you said. It's just, I just go out and I shoot whatever. And I like to say it's a little bit, you know, snotty or like, you know, arrogant to say this, but street photography for me is a way of life. It's corny, but that's kind of how it feels. Like I always have a camera with me, no matter what I'm doing. I'm gonna leave the house. If I know I'm not gonna be shooting much, I bring a little Ricoh GR, you know, tiny camera in my pocket. It's always there. And if I'm gonna go out to shoot, like I really want to shoot, or on a workshop, I might still bring the Ricoh. Sometimes, I mean, it's a great camera, even, you know, doesn't have to be just in your pocket, like it's convenient. Or I bring the big Nikon, right? The point is, I always have a camera on me if I'm out in the city, and I will not hesitate to, on the way to like an appointment and I'm running late, but there's a scene with beautiful light, I will stop and take a picture. And I'll be more late because I'm not gonna, I know if I come back later, this will be gone, whatever it is. So that's why I call it a way of life. It's just like part of my life. It's what I do. I'm shooting everything and everything, you know, anything and everything at all times. But projects do arise from this chaos because there are patterns, right? So if you shoot things enough, actually one of your countrymen, Siegfried Hansen, a really great photographer who I've met, once said to me, or in a, you know, like a presentation that I saw of his, he said he's like a collector. And he just goes around, he collects certain things.
Yeah.
And I really like that. So the example he gave is like those fake plastic ice cream cones that shops have. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So he has a lot of photos of that, for example. And I realized when he said that, I was like, wow, I'm a collector too, because I have also that kind of thing. Like I like shooting bicycles, for example. So I have hundreds of photos of bicycles in various scenarios, right? So that's what I mean. Like that's a project that just kind of arose from the chaos. I didn't plan in advance to say, I'm going to go shoot bicycles and make a project out of it.
Yeah.
It just like, I like them and I realize, I've shot like 50 of these already.
Yeah.
And
it comes naturally.
They keep accumulating. Yeah. Exactly. So now that is a project. And on my website, there is a section for bicycles, but maybe someday it'll be a book. I don't know. But right now I'm just letting them accumulate.
That was a perfect mention of the book itself. So I want to talk a little bit about Tokyo Unseen. And you're doing all kinds of those unseen books. I'm aware of Berlin Unseen and so, I think London Unseen. How did this come into your life?
Okay, so hold on a second. So I remember I listened to your podcast with Alex, and at the end you said what you just said now, and I chuckled myself. I was like, I did not make all the unseen books, okay?
Ah.
So there is a publisher, which is German, actually, Tenois.
Okay.
I think I'm saying that right, Tenois. And the Unseen series is their concept. So they, different photographers did those books. And they did London first, and then I want to say New York, and then Berlin.
Yeah.
And then for Tokyo, they approached me. So each city is a different photographer.
I was sure have done all of them.
No worries.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of makes sense because they're a set, right?
Yeah.
So this publisher, Tenoi, has approached me and they said, okay, we have this concept. And they sent me a copy of the London book. And I was like, that's really cool.
Yeah.
And they said, would you like to do the Tokyo book? And at first I was very shocked because I thought, oh, okay. So you mean like I will contribute to the Tokyo book. There'll be like other photographers. And they said, no, just you, which blew my mind.
Yeah, incredible.
I didn't, I thought, well, wow, this publisher is approaching me. Because I remember a few years ago, I was like cold emailing publishers trying to publish a book and nobody ever got back to me, you know. So, but that was many years ago. And I think my body of work has grown since then a lot. And so I guess they saw some of my work and they thought, okay, this guy has enough to put together a, 200 page book about Tokyo street photography. Mm-hmm. And so that's how that project started.
Got you.
They approached me with it. Mm.
How was it for you? Like you mentioned, you already had a body of work for that book, but how was it for you to fill all those 200 pages?
Well, so when they explained the concept, they, other than the fact that it needs to be street photography and from Tokyo, there was no other, criteria or whatever constraint. It was just like whatever you want. So yeah, I just spent a few weeks looking through thousands of images that I have. Just I'm fairly well organized in my archive of digital photos, but it did take a few weeks to kind of look through stuff and pick out about, like, they said send us like a few hundred, but in the end I sent them 1500 potential photos. Yeah. But I did kind of prioritize them. I said, okay, look, here's like the top 300 as you asked for, but then here's like another set of 300 that are pretty good. And then like another like 800 that are still pretty good. So I kind of gave them a hierarchy.
Yeah.
And in the end, their editor, looked through everything and kind of sourced images actually from all three of those piles pretty equally. So they didn't really, their opinion on what was a top photo versus mine was obviously a little bit different, which is interesting. So having an editor, actually, what I realized, who would, who put together the first draft of like 180 or so images, was really useful because they put some of the like pairings, like the diptychs, you have two photos, one on each page.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those are my doing, but some of them the editor found and I never realized those. I was like, wow, this is, I never realized I had this pair of photos in my collection, so that was really helpful having an editor who would, kind of did the first sequencing. And then, we went through, we revised a lot. So I removed some photos that they chose and put some different photos and we went kind of back and forth and that took a number of revisions. And I probably would have been revising this book till I was like 100 years old or the end of time, but there was a deadline and they said, look, this week, this Friday is the last version. No more changes because it has to go to print. And I'm glad they said that because I would have probably kept revising and changing and removing things.
Yeah.
Because I'm never satisfied. To be frank, I'm still not really satisfied with all the photos in the book. I always, every time I open them, like I should have chose a different one on this page, Mm-hmm. But the thing is, that's me. I'm weird like that. I'm a perfectionist with my work and I'm never fully satisfied. So again, I'm glad that I had the publisher, editor, that whole team to kind of keep me under control. Because I think if I was just self-publishing, the book would still not be finished.
You also added some additional text. Was this the approach from the beginning, or was it more like a personal thing for you? Or what, I'm not aware of the other books, Berlin, mm-hmm. London, stuff like that.
Yeah. So the publisher did say, like, they showed me an example in the London book, and they said, okay, as you see, there's a couple of captions for some of the photos, mm-hmm. and there's an introduction. So the introduction was written by like a writer. I just gave him the like my biography, the broad strokes, but he actually wrote it. Wow. I think he did a great job. I really liked the introduction that mm-hmm. he wrote. But the captions about the photos that are spread throughout the book are written by me. And I'm glad they're there. That didn't feel like artificial. You know, they did say that, yeah, you have to do them. There wasn't an option because that's how their book is designed in this series. But it didn't feel artificial to me because I was glad to, honestly, if it was up to me, you can probably already tell I'm a very verbose person who talks to no end. I would have a caption for every photo because <You know? Yeah. laughs> I always have something to say about my own photos, So whether it's like a technical thing or like the story of how it came to be. So it was also tricky. They'd said, well, you have to choose which photos will get those captions, those little beefier captions. So that was a little tricky. So I was like, okay. And I strategically chose a photos kind of like, that were in my view, sort of big, like milestones on my, on my evolution as a photographer, So mm-hmm. photos where I learned something or something clicked and it just meant something to me. So I did write those captions and I'm glad they're in there. I feel like they add a lot to the book.
Definitely. Absolutely. And mm-hmm. I've read a lot of them and I've got to tell you, being a person who talks a lot and loves talking and is able to talk a lot, that's a perfect addition for a podcast. That's perfect. I'm super stoked to have you here.
I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. One thing I've read in one of those captions was something like, you mentioned as the years go by that you've realized how much of your photography shows places that no longer exist. What's that about? That's a really interesting sentence. Is this city changing so much drastically that you're not able to, go to those places anymore?
Yeah, it's changing very rapidly, and mm-hmm. and in particular, there's this kind of, I actually think, right? I'm sure it's been changing always over the decades, because when I look at photos from like the 70s, the 80s and 90s, they, even though I recognize like, oh, that's Shinjuku being like a downtown part of Tokyo.
Okay.
That's really lively. And I recognize it because a few of the buildings I recognize, but then everything else is different. So of course it's always changing, but I do feel that right now, this last decade or so, and going into the next decade, let's say until 2030 or something, this era, I might be kind of self-centered here and saying, oh, because I'm here now, this is the special time. But it does feel like it's a special time because basically after World War II, Tokyo was completely devastated. There was almost nothing left standing in the city. And then it was rebuilt in a very kind of rough and fast way because they had, they had no choice. And the building materials were often shoddy. A lot of, if you go to these older neighborhoods, you'll see a lot of houses built out of like sheet metal and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It felt very unique in how it was built because of that reason. So it wasn't necessarily a good thing, but it is what it is. It had certain character. And then there was this economic boom in the 70s and 80s. And then again, there was this kind of specialness to that era because things were, booming and people were building these crazy, weird buildings with odd architecture. The point is that all that kind of unique character and more importantly, the people from that era, the people of that age, and this is why I'm saying this is happening now, because what's happening now is the people who built the city in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, well, they're getting very old. And they're retiring or they're actually passing away, right? And they're gone. And they don't have anybody who's going to take over their little tiny restaurant, that's built out of, crappy metal and wood, that's about to fall apart. Basically, it just disappears, right? So as that generation disappears and they're like, the artifacts of that generation, meaning the city, will also disappear. And what it's getting replaced with is something very commercial, very clean, sterile, and sort of soulless, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And so that means I think in like another 60 years, I don't know if we're going to be looking back on, you know, on what do you call it? On the buildings that are being built or the city that's, you know, being created now with the same kind of nostalgia that we're looking back on that Tokyo from that era that I just discussed. Right. So yeah, that's my feeling on that. That's why I have this, that feeling comes across in my photos because I'm on like the tail end of this era of Tokyo.
Get you.
Where I'm seeing the last remnants of this stuff go away and I'm seeing it in my photos. Like, wow, I still have a photo of this old house from, you know, 50 years ago and now it's gone.
Do you have some kind of responsibility to that you're going to have to collect those pictures to make them available for future generations and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's part of it. But, you know, honestly, it's a little worse than responsibility. It's actually a regret that I didn't appreciate these things enough in my in my 15 years that I've been in Japan. Because when I got here, I didn't understand anything of what I just told you. This whole thing. I was just like a wide-eyed, you know, new kid from America / Poland, whatever you want to call it, who's just like, wow, Tokyo, it's amazing. You know, like, this is so cool. Not understanding anything of what I just described, not appreciating that things are going to go away. And so I actually feel I didn't photograph these things nearly enough that I should have. And I did what I did. So I don't feel I'm actually the best, archivist or documentarian of Tokyo. I kind of shoot, as I already said, like this very sort of, you know, my experiences, it's kind of self-centered. Like, this is what I see today. This is what I'm shooting today. And I shoot the modern cool high-rise buildings too, and this stuff as well, because it's also visually interesting. But there are other photographers that I'm going to give a shout out to, my good friend Lee Chapman, who actually shoots these kind of things. And you should interview him next. I'm going to recommend him to you. Yeah. He's really good. And he is a photographer who really goes deep into these old parts of Tokyo and understands these things that I just described much better than I do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I only have a bit of that sentiment in my work, but this other photographer is really good. Lee Chapman, look him up. He's great.
awesome. But, Lucas, I'm like I mentioned before, I'm flicking through the book while you're talking, while you're explaining it to me. I would love to know. I asked the same question Alex Munoz, but I would love to know what's your perspective about this? How do the Japanese people react to your kind of photography? Because I feel when I'm looking at those pictures, for example, page 73, Green Phone is it called? It's a man who's on this in this photo booth or something like that, and he's trying to call somebody, and it feels like you are with him in this photo booth. You're so close. Your photography is so close to the people. So my question would be, how do they react to your photography?
So, yeah, it's a great question. I find that people just ignore me, actually.
Yeah.
And I will say about my approach too, because you say I am so close, and I am very close. But I just want to point out one other thing, that over the years, my approach changed a little bit, because in the beginning, and some of the photos in the book are from this early days, from like 2010, 11, 12, 13. Mm-hmm. I was very, very shy, and I was like terrified of photographing people and getting some sort of negative reaction, right? So I tended to be either very quick about what I was doing, or I would often shoot from the hip. You know, I learned how to do zone focus with the manual lens, and I would shoot from the hip. And I did that, I would say, successfully, in the sense that I got some good images that way. But then eventually I realized that this is wrong. This is not a good approach. And my approach now evolved into just being very direct and obvious about what I'm doing. Because I realized that it's not good to hide what I'm doing. Because if I'm hiding what I'm doing, that sort of, how would I say, like, betrays the fact or suggests that I'm doing something wrong. Like, if you're hiding it, you must be doing something wrong, right?
Totally.
And I don't feel I'm doing something wrong. So I realized, why am I hiding it? So I stopped. So now I rarely, almost never shoot from the hip. I just bring the camera up, you know, to my eye, or sometimes I look down at the screen, like from above, you know, with the flip out screen, but I'm never hiding what I'm doing. And when people see me, and they often do, I just smile at them and I might say something nice like, oh, I like how you look, you know, you look nice, you look cool in Japanese or sometimes in English, depends on the person.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll direct them. I'll say, take another drag of your cigarette, you know, do that again. and that rarely makes a nice picture. Like I already, that first candid moment is more important, but just by playing around with the person and letting them pose, it makes them feel relaxed. Like, oh, okay, I'm going to pose for this guy. So 99% of the time people ignore me. Sometimes I interact with them. And they never get angry, or almost never. Like once a year, someone gets angry.
Oh, crazy! Yeah. And what they tell you then? What do they want to delete their photo or what?
No. They just, when I say get angry, I just mean they look annoyed and they do this hand wave motion, like go away. And I say, oh, okay, sorry, and I go.
Okay.
That's it. They don't like chase me down the street with a knife and, you know, shout at me. I don't mean literally angry. I just mean like they obviously don't want their
photo
taken.
Like it. Okay.
Yeah, they don't like it. And then I always respect that, of course. I say, oh, okay, sure. Sorry. No, I'll move on. But it's never been like an altercation or like a big problem or anything like that. So it's pretty chill. Now, it could be just because I look like a tourist. Like, people always say that to me, like Japanese photographers will say that to me. It's like, oh, it's because you look like a tourist. But I think there's some truth to that, but I don't think that's the main reason. I think it's because I'm very obvious about what I'm doing. I make eye contact with people. If they see me, I never run away. I smile at them. Mm-hmm. And I just make it very transparent what I'm doing. And I think people then just can accept that. And they say, okay, he's all right.
That sounds like a great approach to do that. Mm-hmm. How are you aware of the laws in Japan about street photography? Because I don't know if you know, but in Germany, it's a little bit rough. It's more tight. You're not allowed by law to take those pictures and do something with them. And you could get sued if you're just printing a book or something like that. How's it in Japan?
Yeah, it's interesting because recently I spoke to a number of Germans about that, like people in my workshops and stuff, and it came up. And everybody gave me a slightly different version, so I don't know which one's correct. But we don't need to go into the German version.
I think we all just, do not know just, exactly, because if you are that, no lawyer, it's difficult.
That's what I'm getting at. It seems like nobody really knows. But anyway, in Japan, I am also, by the way, not a lawyer. Okay. But I did research this pretty carefully because I wanted to know. And I even spoke to a friend of mine who is a lawyer. This is a long time ago. But then I just looked it up on the Japanese Wikipedia because it's actually pretty well explained over there. And so basically it's like this. It's very similar to America where your right to free, you know, personal expression, freedom of speech, or whatever you want to call it, is protected in the Japanese constitution. I want to say it's Article 9 of the constitution, something like that. So you are totally free in your right to take photos of people or anything in a public place, okay? Because that is just your right. In a private place, of course, that's the rules of that place. They could tell you, hey, no photos here, right? But it's not the individuals, right? It's not the people of that place. Like if you go to like a store and there's people in the store, they can't tell you, don't take my picture. It's the store itself that can have that rule or not, right? So basically you can take photos anywhere you want within reason, right? Any kind of place where somebody, even if it's a public place, but they can expect privacy, of course it's forbidden. So like, you know, you can't go to like a changing room or something, obviously, right? Sure. That's common sense. And then as for the publishing of the photos, that is also totally legal, my understanding. You could publish photos however you like, except that if you publish the photos and then somebody can prove that you've somehow damaged them by publishing those photos, they will probably have grounds to sue you for some amount of money. But it's not illegal. So you're never going to go to prison over this, unless, again, you're doing some weird pervy photos. That's obviously very illegal. But just normal photos of people in the street, it's not illegal. The police will never get involved. I've never heard of the police getting involved or anything like that. It's just that person could potentially sue you if you published, you know, their image, and they could prove damages in some way. Right. And of course, if you use it commercially, if you use their face to advertise a product, then they will definitely sue you, and then they will definitely win because you should pay them for that. Right. That's obvious as well. But something like my book, which is an editorial work, right? It's a work of art. It's basically fair game. Now, if some of the people in the book discover they were in the book and then could, you know, make a claim that somehow I, you know, hurt them by publishing their photo in the book, they could have grounds to sue me. But, you know, that's a chance that we all just take as photographers here in Tokyo. So that's how it works. No. My non-lawyer understanding of it.
But it sounds really experienced from what you're doing. You even knew the chapter in the law and stuff like that. So Yeah, yeah. Germany is difficult. Germany is difficult besides all that. And but I love your approach. Especially, I've seen the picture on page 110. It's a man who blinks through a little window. It's like you mentioned before, those plastic windows or something like that. And you told that you tried 15 minutes to get the perfect shot of him. Mm-hmm. Is this something you're regularly doing?
Yeah, it will depend. Not always, but regularly, in the sense that, yeah, it's a common thing. So if I find a scene that I really like and I know that I can get a good picture there, if I just, you know, work on it, then I will easily stay in that one spot for a long time. Now in the case of that photo though, of course, like I don't know if he noticed me or not. He might have noticed me right away because it's pretty obvious that, you know, we could kind of see each other, but he ignored me. So he was acting like he was just doing his own thing. If he was interacting with me, if he started like posing or something, I would have probably taken a few photos and waved to him and said, okay, thank you. And I would have left because I don't want people posing. I want them to look natural. Right. But trying to, you know, find a good composition, definitely I will spend a lot of time on it. And little side note with that photo, the one that ended up in the book was very difficult to choose because I took a lot of photos in that time that I was there.
Yeah.
And I like a lot of them. And they're all a little bit different, where his expression is different and the framing was a little bit different. So one risk of taking a long time and working the scene and taking lots of pictures is that you end up with too many pictures and it's hard to choose the perfect one. So, but in the book, I chose one of that set that is kind of playful because he's sort of peeking in a fun way. I thought that was very cute. So I chose that one. Whereas the other ones, he was a little more serious in his expression. So I thought, let's just go with the fun one for the book.
Get you. You mentioned that you spent 50 minutes there. Can you tell me, how long do those sessions take? You're going to do street photography. How long will it take in general? 1 hour, two hours?
Like I said, I always bring my camera no matter what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, I'm just, sometimes my, you know, street photography session is literally, as I said, like on the way to something, you know, I'm going to the dentist and there's a scene. I take a picture.
Nice.
But that aside, if I am actually going out to shoot, like I'm going to go shoot. Yeah, it'll range anywhere from 3 to 6 hours or something like that.
Basically, if it's a conscious decision to do so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. My approach is usually, I don't like to go, after a meal because then I'm very slow. My brain's not working well. So usually I'll go in the afternoon and I will just shoot until I'm starving. And once I can't take it anymore, I go eat something and then I go home.
Get you.
And I find my mind is sharper when I'm hungry.
When you're hungry,
but eventually there's a limit, right? Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's usually the limiting factor. Not so much my feet. It's more my stomach. My stomach determines when I'm finished.
Nice. You also mentioned that you've been a pretty shy person. I'm sure that was a conflicting point while doing your type of photography. How did you overcome this?
So I was definitely a shy person and photography it wasn't a conscious decision to say, I'm going to use photography to get over my shyness, naturally that's what it did. But it wasn't only the photography itself. It was also, you know, living in Tokyo and I was meeting lots of people and I was meeting, of course, like Japanese people who are, you know, like being like a non-Japanese person who doesn't speak very good Japanese. It was extra daunting. So just over my years here, I became more outgoing in general, but photography definitely played a big part of that because it forced me to put myself out there. And as I already mentioned, like I used to be terrified of interacting with people. I thought if I take their picture and they say something, even if they're not going to be mad, I don't know what I'm going to say. So I had this tendency to like escape. If I thought someone's going to see me, I'd just walk away quickly. But over the years, I just sort of got used to it and started to have fun talking to people. And if somebody says something to me, I just talk to them back. And then, you know, I realized that nothing's going to go wrong, at least in this city. You know, no one's going to get, as I already said, super angry or anything like that. People are chill. People are very friendly. They're mostly, if anything, just kind of puzzled by what I'm doing. And if I explain it to them, I say, just like how you look. I'm just taking pictures, you know, whatever. Then they understand and it's amusing, right?
I think it's incredible. I think it's incredible, Lucas, because if I'm thinking about approaching photography, especially street photography, and I'm a shy person, it could be a really frightening idea to do street photography. I would be more drawn to landscape and stuff like that without any people.
Yeah, totally. And so, like, I don't know when the transition happened, but there was definitely a shift. Like, you know, 2010 Lucas, when I started photography in 2010 in Tokyo, is very different in how I interact with, you know, 2024 Lucas with people on the street.
Sure.
You know, doing the workshops also over the last 10 years almost, because we started this in 2015, the iExplore business, right? You know, I meet a lot of people. Like, I meet every day, I meet a different person, and it's always a stranger, right? And it's someone I'm meeting for the first time and say, hey, hello, how's it going? All right, where are you from? Cool, let's go shooting together, right? So meeting a lot of people and getting to know a lot of people like that also helped me be more extroverted and less, a little bit less introverted. And I enjoy meeting people and chatting with them. I enjoy doing this podcast and chatting with you, for example.
Yeah.
And then one other little benefit there, and maybe this is a tip for the listeners out there who are shy and want to do street photography. If you do it with a buddy, even like not necessarily a friend, but like I said, the people I was doing workshops with, right? There's kind of a safety in numbers. And when I'm together with them, I naturally get a little more brave because like I'm the leader. I'm the running the workshop. So I got to go a little bit. I got to take some risks here, right? Because I want them to have a good time. And a lot of the people on my workshops are shy. Right. They're not necessarily shy people, but they're shy about street photography. They're worried like, oh, can I take a picture? Oh, I don't know. And so I have to always take the first step. And so by being in that situation over years, it also kind of forced me to get even more out of my comfort zone. And so now, like, I'm literally something's like dragging people out. It's really funny. There'll be like some cool scene and I naturally want to get pretty close, as you can see in a lot of my photos.
Yeah.
And then the person I'm with kind of stands far back and I'm like, no. Come here. And it's like kind of weird because if you're doing street photography on your own, you don't talk to anybody, right? You just kind of, it's you and the camera, you blend in. If the subject notices you or not, you may talk to them. But I'll be like literally like talking to a person, say, come over here and take a picture of this person. And this person is sitting there seeing that. And it's kind of funny, but in the end, it always works out because I'm very transparent about what I'm doing. And I try to keep a smile on my face and make it fun for everybody. So it works out.
Sounds great. Sounds incredible. Now I would love to do some street photography. It's really engaging talking to you. but Lucas, what makes Japan special for you, especially Tokyo? What makes it special for you in comparison to other cities?
So first I'll tell you the cliche answer that I think everybody says, and I've said this a million times too, but it's true. So I'm going to say it real quick. It has this wonderful mix of like old stuff and new stuff, tradition, modernity, right? I already kind of alluded to that.
Yeah.
Right? It's changing over the years. So there's still a lot of that old stuff left. And that gives Tokyo a vibe that like some cities, well, very few other cities in the world have. Maybe like Hong Kong has some of that. I've been there and it does definitely have a similar vibe. Probably Taipei, which I've never been to, basically Asian cities, but like European cities don't quite have the same vibe. So anyway, so there's that. But to me, that's not really the thing that really makes Tokyo special. What makes Tokyo special for me is that you always can very easily, just by no real like planning or anything, just by accident, you just fall into adventures. That's what's special about Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
You go out and you just start walking and suddenly you're in a cool neighborhood that you've never been to before. And there's a cool shop and you go in there and there's interesting people and you're photographing something, you know, it's just like, it always feels like an adventure and you can do it very easily on foot, which is important for street photography, right? You don't need a car. You can walk everywhere. There's trains. If ever you get tired, there's always a train station nearby. You just walk over there and go home, right? You're never like far from civilization, so to speak. So it's easy to just get lost. And also it's very, very safe. So you'll never get robbed. You don't have to worry that you're out in the middle of the night with an expensive camera looking over your shoulder. It's totally fine. So it's just so easy to have an adventure. And that's what made me really fall in love with Tokyo in the first place.
Before you told me about the safety aspect, I wanted to ask you if it's chained to the sheer size of this city. Could it be doable in New York? Obviously, in another city, of course it can be done there, but the safety aspect was something that gave me some ease of mind here. I wouldn't tell that about other cities. I wouldn't like to do something like street photography in the night in Berlin at the train station or in New York or something like that. I think that's something really special.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and this is, of course, true everywhere in Japan. Like, Japan is just an extremely safe country. with very, very low crime rates, especially the kind of crime like, yeah. like, you know, people stealing stuff on the street. This is an unheard of.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Chris, is this something typical for Japan? Is this something in the society which is linked into the society, or is it just a coincidence?
Oh, well, that's a big question. And I'm not a trained sociologist, right? But, but I do feel that there are just aspects to the culture. And I don't want to be one of those people, because Japan does often get put on a pedestal as some sort of like utopia where, oh, they have the samurai code of honor. Okay, now that's a bunch of nonsense, right? Like, you know, it's also, I'm just going to say, it does also have some flaws. It's not a perfect place. But yeah, having said that, there is, from a young age, I think everybody here is indoctrinated or taught some, like, kind of two main sort of, how would I say, like, concepts or ideas that just get drummed into everybody from the beginning. And that is, one, the idea that you're part of a collective and you're not an individual. So there's a kind of a collectivist culture where you're always, you know, you're working towards some bigger thing. You're not just you. Whereas like Americans, mm-hmm. we're the most individualistic people on earth, yeah. right? It's just like, everything's me, 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 and I'm going to get mine. And like, it's very competitive, right? So here in Japan, people are less like that. And so therefore you know, you're less likely to do something like steal something on the street, because you have a sense of responsibility to the greater society. So you don't want to, you know, steal stuff, because if everybody was stealing stuff, that would be bad for society, right? That doesn't mean there are no criminals, though. Of course, there are people who sure. totally ignore that and do criminals. And there's a second concept, which is part of Japanese culture deeply. And I'm sure there's like some, you know, Japan sociologists who are like, you know, cringing at everything I'm saying. That's stupid, but this is my understanding. Mm-hmm. And this is this concept they call wa. The Japanese word wa means harmony. And in fact, they often use this concept to refer to Japan itself. So for example, in Japanese, when you want to say Western food, you say yoshoku, which literally means like Western food. Mm-hmm. But if you say Japanese food, you don't say Japanese food, you say washoku, which literally means harmonious food.
Oh.
Right? So the term wa and Japan are kind of synonymous. It's a place of harmony. So that's the second thing that's kind of drummed into people from a very young age, is yeah. you should always try to respect and maintain the wa. So you don't want to be loud. This is why people are quiet on the train, for example, mm-hmm. if you're riding train in Tokyo, mm-hmm. unless it's like Friday night and everyone's drunk. But every other time of day, it's quiet. This is why people line up for things, right? Because it's harmonious, right? Yeah. And then this is why I think people commit less crimes, because it's just that is a chaotic thing. You just don't do that. You respect the rules, right? So that's my understanding. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds great.
Not
sounds
an expert.
Good. Something something that goes in the same direction. But could you imagine doing something different in terms of photography, or even doing street photography but in another city? Two questions.
Oh, totally. I've always dreamed of doing, you know, street photography in other cities. And I mean, yeah. I have a bit. I've traveled around Asia. I've been to like Hong Kong and Bangkok and some other cities. And I've been to Europe a bit, although Europe never really like stimulated my creative mm-hmm. juices that much, you know, for photography, but it did to some degree. I went to Dubrovnik a few years ago and I had a really great time shooting there for 5 days. I took some cool photos, but it was only 5 days. So I just scratched the surface. It's kind of meaningless, right? But what I find is basically, no matter what I'm doing, I really got to put the hours in. And when I say hours, I mean like hundreds of hours. So my big challenge is that I'm very, you know, like rooted here in Tokyo. It's very hard for me to go somewhere else for like a few months or something, or multiple trips to a place to really build up those hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I wouldn't mind. I would love to say spend a year shooting in Hong Kong or something, or some other city. I say Hong Kong because I really like that city. I've been there and it was really cool, but I only spent a week there. So maybe someday. Now, I think the other part of your question was, would I do something that's like not street photography or something
exactly.
else, right? And that, I mean, as I already said, I do. The book is about street photography, and I guess people know me for that, but I do shoot a lot of architecture. I do like kind of urbex sort of stuff. I do shoot some nature stuff around Japan a little bit, but again, I have not put enough hours into it to really say, okay, I can make like a book of nature photos, you know, for example. It's just not, you know, because to me, art is really, it's like peeling an onion or, you know, digging into the ground. You know, you just do it inch by inch, layer by layer. It doesn't happen. You can't make it happen quickly. That's how I feel about it. At least that's how I do it. So it ends up being that whatever I can spend the most time on is what I, you know, feel I do the most meaningful work on. And what I end up spending the most time on is shooting around Tokyo in various ways. So that's what I do. I'm not against those other
things. Yeah, get you. Totally get you. But do you think there could be a time in the future, in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, where you're going to say, okay, now I've seen everything. The offer which the city is giving me exceeded. I do not have anything else. I've seen everything. Could you imagine that this point is going to come? Or do you think it's such a big city? There are so many possibilities and I could photograph the city for my whole life.
Yeah, I think I could see myself getting like basically bored or tired of shooting in Tokyo and then go somewhere else. But I don't think it would be because I've shot everything or I've found everything the city has to offer. It wouldn't be that I've like reached the goal or the top of the mountain. It would be because I just got tired of climbing the mountain. But the mountain is infinite when it comes to Tokyo.
Get you.
And I'll just highlight that point. I'll just say I know this for a fact because there was a point a few years ago where I did feel like, oh yeah, I've done everything. I should probably branch out to other stuff. And then I went deeper and I realized I don't know anything. And I found so much more cool stuff and ways of approaching the city and things to shoot. And, you know, various, like I already said earlier, like projects arose out of the chaos of all the random stuff I shoot, stuff that I didn't expect. And so what I learned is just if you love something, you put more and more time into it and you will reap those rewards. And if you give up, that's okay. Nothing wrong with giving up and moving on to something else. But I'm nowhere near that point right now in my life, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now I want to talk a little bit more about your book. When I'm looking at those pictures, they are all really colorful and they're really popping. They're really saturated and vivid. And I really love looking at those pictures. But I do not see any black and white photography. Is this something... Mm-hmm. Is this something you approach, black and white photography, or do you say I'm more the color guy?
Yeah, I'm definitely the color guy. So basically, when I was starting out, I didn't know what I was doing or what would be cool. And of course, there's a lot of great black and white photography out there, which I love looking at. Nothing wrong with it. It's really awesome. Yeah. And so I did shoot some stuff in black and white, but of course, I'm using digital, right? I've only played around with film a little bit. You know, I've taken a few film photos. I have a simple film camera. That's like an old one. I have a Ishika Electro 35. It's a cool little camera. But I've only probably shot like four rolls with it or something. And then I gave up. So I never shot on, and it was color film. I never shot on black and white film. And my problem was that when I was shooting in the early days with digital and then, you know, making the photos black and white later, right? In Lightroom or whatever, it always felt so like contrived to me, right? To me, I'm not saying that's true for everybody's black and white work, especially if you're shooting black and white film. That's cool. And like, again, I highlight there's a lot of great photographers out there whose black and white work I love. But when I was making my own, I always felt like I'm just like putting on this filter of black and white. That's how it felt like to me in the beginning.
Yeah.
Whether that's right or wrong, you know, this is how it felt. So I made a decision a long time ago that, you know what, I'm just going to shoot color because color just feels natural. It doesn't feel contrived that I'm like adding in this, you know, this making this conscious choice to, okay, I'm going to make it black and white after the fact. You know what I mean? So it just felt right to shoot in color. And so I did that. And now I've been doing it so long that it's just like what I do. And like 99.99999% of my photos are in color.
Yeah.
So it would be weird to throw in like one black and white photo into the book. Yeah, so it just, absolutely. That's why they're just all in color. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's an interesting idea. That those color photos are contrived, are artificial and something like that, because you are just applying a preset, a filter to make them black and white. But maybe I was thinking about doing it with proper white, black and white film or even a monochrome camera or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's what I'm saying. Like if I would shoot black and white that way, it would make more sense to me. Now, when I was starting out, there was no monochrome film or digital cameras. That's a recent development. But anyway, those are expensive. Leica is not a cheap item.
Yeah.
But then film for sure. My thing with film is just like I'm very lazy.
Yeah.
and film always felt like extra steps. And again, I'm not trashing I always have to say this because I feel like people get a little bit defensive about whether, like, whether it's film or digital. Like when you're, mm-hmm. when this discussion comes up, whether you're either camp you're in, people treat it almost like sports teams or politics or something. Like, oh, you're on the blue team. I'm on the red team. Let's fight. And so that's why I keep saying these disclaimers. Like, I'm not against either film or whatever, or black and white or anything anyway. But for me, when the idea of shooting on film is just like, extra steps. And I don't really care so much about the process. And honestly, these days I'm like overwhelmed with the amount of digital editing that I'm doing of photos. So maybe I should switch to film because then I don't have to edit. They just come out the way they come out. But then there's the other problem. I have to develop them. And also film is expensive. There's also that issue.
Sure.
So the point is, if I could somehow have a magic box that I click the photo, you know, I push the button and the photo comes out exactly as I want it to come out, whether it's digital or film, yeah. I would totally do that.
Yeah.
So, but right now, this fastest process that I have is to shoot digital and edit in, you know, Adobe's suite of whatever software.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Lightroom or whatever. And then that's just works for me. I just try to get the images out fast because I'm all about just shooting more and more and more and more and more rather than like going deep into the process of developing the image. That's kind of how I think about it.
So you mentioned you are a perfectionist before, but in terms of editing, your thing, is it more like, okay, photos in, preset applied, that's it, out? Or do you invest a lot of time?
Not quite. I do edit each photo from the, like, you know, from the beginning. I don't use any presets whatsoever.
Okay.
So I do put, because I am a perfectionist, but I try to do that as fast as I can, right? Okay. So I've gotten very good at it. And over the years, I've edited probably like 100,000 photos, right? So. Yeah. To me, like when I open up a digital photo in, you know, Adobe Camera Raw and I want to start editing it, I know exactly what I'm going to do to that photo from the beginning. So it just takes a few minutes because I've just done it so many times. I wish I could apply presets, but you can't because every photo is different. And to me, presets don't make sense. It just doesn't work for me.
Hmm. Ah, that's pretty interesting. That's pretty interesting. So do you already know how to edit a certain picture in a different way while you're shooting, while you're taking the picture itself? Or is it more like when you're loading it into Lightroom or something like that?
Yeah, while I'm taking it, I'm not thinking so much about the edit because there's already so many things to think about when you're shooting, you know, the timing, the composition, all that stuff. Yeah, I do have, like, if you were to ask me in the moment, say, Lucas, how are you going to edit this later? I could tell you. Like, I could tell you at least what I would try first. And if that, for some reason, doesn't work. And by the way, if I'm editing and it's just like the best photos actually don't require much editing because the light is already good. The colors are already there. Like, I'm not trying to polish a turd, as the idiom goes, you know what I mean? Like, you're not trying to take a piece of crap and make it look good. You're just taking a great image and just making it perfect, right? So if like I'm shooting something in the moment, I already know what I'm going to do to it later because it's not much that it needs to be done. And if I'm sometimes struggling, like, oh, that's a cool scene, but I'm editing and the colors just don't look good or whatever, I usually just give up and say, this image is trash. I don't delete it. I leave it. It's just there. But like, I don't finish it. I move on to a different image. You know, I'm not trying to save every single photo with my edits. It's not my motivation.
Get you. What's your ratio, Lucas? When you're out and about and it's a conscious decision, you're going to have a proper street photography session and you're about 3-6 hours, something like that. What's your ratio of pictures you're going to take home and you're satisfied with? You're saying to yourself, that was a great trip. I got 5 photos. I got 10. What's the ratio there?
It's interesting because it used to be that I was, of course, less satisfied. And now these days I'm more satisfied. So you'd think, oh, it's because I got better at it.
Yeah.
But that's, I think that's the reason. I actually have become easier to satisfy. Like, and it's not that my standards necessarily got lower. It's that I enjoy more kinds of scenes because, so I used to shoot, let's say like 100 photos would be a lot, you know? Now, if I come home, I'll probably have like 500 or 600, which is insane. That's another reason I don't shoot film, because I would be bankrupt by now. and then I'm ruthless though when I come home. When I come home, then I delete 90% of those. Okay. Oh.
Crazy.
So then I just outright delete. I don't even keep them, like storing them somewhere. Why? There's no point. We'll never look at them again. And then what's left, I might edit like half of them. And then from that, I might post like 1 or 2 or 3. 10 if it's like a really special day or something.
Yeah.
So, but
Lucas, what's the amount? What are we talking about? 100 pictures, 200, 500? What are we talking about?
Well, so that's what I'm saying. Like if I go out just shooting on my own and it's like really good area, it's busy, there's a lot of stuff to shoot, I'll probably shoot like 600 photos 600? Or something like that.
Okay.
600 clicks, right? But then when I get home, 80, 90% of that gets deleted immediately. So I'm down to like 100 or so, right? 100 or so. And then I will select from those maybe like 50 to 60, maybe even all 100 for editing. But that's just because I want to edit them to see what they look like when they're done. But I'm not actually going to publish all that. There's no way. It ends up being only like 10 to 15 photos at most from like a set of 600. And then, that number has grown over the years. Not because like, oh, I've gotten better at it or whatever. I don't think that's what it is. It's that I actually shoot a bigger variety of stuff now. So when I go out, as I already said, I'm not only doing street photography, but I'm shooting like, oh, there's a cool pipe here. Oh, that's a cool building. You know, like just, I'm more open to just shooting everything. I'm very like just open. Whatever I like, I shoot. As I already said, even like nature stuff, for example, which seems to be totally unrelated to what I usually do, but actually I like it. It doesn't matter. So then therefore I end up with more photos that, you know, I want to finalize or that I like because just my interests have grown, like the horizon have broadened, I should say. My interests have become more broad.
That's such an interesting approach to your style of work that you're going to delete so many photos after the initial view, the initial sighting of them. Because what was I experiencing the last weeks and months was something like, I'm shooting primarily on film and I'm keeping all of those photos, all of those scans are going to be placed on my hard drive. And from time to time, I'm going to revisit them and checking for some hidden gems maybe. Because initially I'm just flicking through those pictures and searching for those perfect shots with air quotes here. And I'm just overlooking some of those hidden gems, maybe. And I experienced this a lot recently that I'm, for example, now in the winter here in Germany, I'm just flicking through some of those pictures I have taken during summer. And from time to time, I'm going to, explore some of those hidden gems. And you are, as you told me, you are not able to do so because you are instantly deleting some of them. And that's a pretty interesting approach because you don't give yourself the chance to revisit them with another lens, with another sharpening, with another sharpened eyes or something like that.
Yeah. So two things about that. I think the first one is that even more than just when I come home, I already know I'm going to delete photos the moment I take them. Like I take it and I'm like, this is going to get deleted. This is a piece of crap. Immediately I know that. But I never delete them in the camera because that's the chance. So you look back at them like sometime later. The chance I'm going to give them is okay when I get home, and then I don't usually look at them that day. Like they accumulate on the camera for a few days, and then like every few days I look through like a few days worth of photos, right, when I have time. And so that's the grace period they get before they are executed. You know, so, but usually I almost always instantly know like, okay, these are going to get deleted. And then another reason I don't waste time deleting them while I'm shooting is because I don't want to think about that while I'm shooting. I want to focus on the environment around me, right? So I don't think about it, but I just know, I feel it right away. And the second thing is though, that especially film shooters, but not only film shooters, like you got to be a little more selective because that I already alluded. Sure. You're not going to go out and shoot 600 photos. That's what, like 20 rolls, right? I mean, that's like, no. It's like a plane ticket to Japan costs that much money, probably, right? So you're going to be more selective. If I was shooting on film, I would definitely shoot less. So the reason I can shoot so much is because I'm, of course, shooting a digital camera like many people do. So there's no cost to it. So I tend to take a lot of chances, meaning I will take photos of things that I have a low feeling that there's going to be a good photo there, but I just try it anyway. I just try it.
Getcha.
And experiment a lot. And so that's why I know that these are, you're right. It's true that I do have some photos that I'm not going to delete, but I'm not really thinking highly of, but I'm going to keep them because maybe I'll change my mind about it. But those are few. There's a lot more that are just like total, they were tries.
Yeah.
And I know they didn't work. So there's no point to keep these photos. One more thing. I also go back to the same places to shoot a lot. you know, like certain parts of Tokyo. Part of it is because of the workshops that I do, which we always go to the same areas. Cause you know, every time someone books one of these tours, I got to take them in the same area, right? Cause everyone's experiencing it for the first time, but also because these areas are exciting. And so I tend to shoot them anyway. Things like these areas are like those who know Tokyo, places like Shinjuku, Shibuya, Ikebukuro, Ginza, Shinbashi. Anybody who's visited Tokyo will recognize these names. These are, you know, big areas in Tokyo. So, you know, because I go to the same street corner again and again and again and again, and I will probably shoot similar things, right? There's no point to keep every, like, you know, random failed snapshot of that spot, because I know I'm going to go back there tomorrow and I can try again and I'll probably get something better. If I didn't delete so many photos, I would probably live in a house made out of hard drives at this point. So,
have you ever been surprised by this approach? So that you've taken those tickets and have been surprised by one shot you weren't aware of, that this is going to be a perfect shot, a 10 out of 10, something like that.
You mean like if I shot it and then I came home later and I was like, wow, this is actually pretty good?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
Yes, sometimes. That definitely happens, for sure. I can't think of a specific photo that I had that experience right off the top of my head, but I'm sure it's happened before. But again, usually like, I know I have a good shot. Like if I have a good shot, I know it right away. I'm like, oh, this is good. This is great.
Okay.
You know? And then if I don't feel that, then I know that it's just like I said, maybe I keep it, maybe not, but it's probably going to go in the trash.
Totally get you. It's the approach of getting a lot of tickets to eventually get the jackpot. Yeah.
But I will say it's not like random. I'm not just like randomly doing stuff, you know, spray and pray, as it's called. No. I'm being very deliberate. It's just that I'm very open to trying things that have a low probability of success, but I try them anyway. That's kind of how I think about it.
Understand. Perfect. Lucas, I've checked my list with all questions I wanted to ask you, and there's one thing missing before we're going to approach the pics category. And I've seen one picture in your book. It's on page 189. It's this lady standing in front of a field full of, I don't know exactly what it is. You have to explain it to me. And there's one guy who fell over this. Uh-huh. I don't know what's the exact word for this. And he's lying on the ground. This lady is just looking over her shoulder back to you, not necessarily into your camera, but to the side. And this guy's laying over there without doing anything. And was he drunk or something like that? I wanted to know the story behind it.
So this is, I'm glad you asked, because that's a fun one that a lot of people can't figure. I mean, obviously because I was there and I took it, so I know what was happening.
Yeah.
And when I look at the photo, it's obvious to me what's happening, but you're right. It does look like he fell in there and he's drunk or something. So what this is in an area called Ueno, and there's a pond there. It's called Shinobazu Pond. It's a pond, and it's full of lotuses, lotus plants, right? Yeah. And those are big lotus leaves, and they bloom in the summer, I think, with this beautiful white flower, pink or white flower that comes out of the mud. Mm-hmm. And it's a symbol of Buddhism and stuff. It's pretty cool. Beautiful flowers. So, but right now it's the middle of summer. The flowers are gone. It's just these big green leaves. And this is a couple, and I don't know who dropped something, but one of them dropped something. I like to think she dropped something. And then he went over there to try to get it back for his girlfriend, right? And I love the picture because, he's struggling so hard to reach into this pond to get whatever was dropped. And then she's looking back at me with this sort of slightly facetious look like, I got him doing my bidding, you know?
He's doing that every time. Does that
pretty much, yeah. And so that's what that scene is about. That's what it is about. Yeah.
Great, because it was just starting my imagination, and what's this about? I wasn't aware of the pond, and I was thinking this guy is drunk or something like that, and slipped over that gate or so. But okay, now I get the story. Thank you so much. Perfect, Lucas. Like I mentioned, I would love to go into the pics category to slowly close this show for this episode. We are at over an hour, which is pretty great. It flew away like nothing. That's perfect. Yeah. Do you have something prepared?
Well, I prepared, you said it could be anything, right?
Anything.
Any category, whatever.
Anything,
right?
Yes.
Okay. So So I'm gonna do two things. I'm gonna do a fast category and a slow category. Okay?
Yeah, sure.
Fast category is food in Tokyo. If you come to Tokyo, you have to try tonkatsu, which is a fried pork cutlet, which a lot of people miss this. They don't. They go for the ramen and the sushi and whatever, and you gotta try tonkatsu. It's this like, it's really, really good. It's really good. Nice. It's not like a hidden thing. Everybody knows, it's famous. Everybody knows this, but a lot of people miss it. That's my fast fun one. Okay.
Yeah.
The more serious one is I just went through, my Insta, like people I follow on Instagram, whose work that I like. And I figured I just promote like three or four photographers who,
yeah, sure.
Who I like. Is that okay?
That's perfect.
Or if you want, give me a category. Cause that actually is what I struggle
Lucas,
with.
Lucas, that's absolutely perfect. You have perfect picks. Okay. Food and Instagram accounts is 10 out of 10. Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. So the Instagram accounts are, I don't know, because this is just audio only. So should I spell them out so people can
You don't have to. You can just tell them and I'm going to put them in the show notes for sure. So okay. send them over to me after this episode.
I'll send them
I'm
over
going
to you.
To include
okay.
them. Yeah, sure.
So one of them, I'll start with a black and white photographer to prove that I'm not against black and white photography.
Yeah.
His name is Adam Vincent. Yeah. And I've been following him for a few years now. Actually on a website called DeviantArt where I've been posting forever, but he's also on Instagram.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he does these awesome black and white photos, kind of in the vein of like Daido Moriyama, right? You know, or Tatsuo Suzuki, but he makes it his own. It's different. And he is kind of like me is what I like about him. He also shoots a ton of photos and he posts a lot of photos.
Yeah.
And like me, I think he also has like some, I don't know how many he deletes, but he definitely has some that are less strong and more strong, but the strong ones are really strong. So he's got some great photos. So this guy, definitely check it out. He only has like 300 followers. He should have like 300,000 because his work is amazing. Okay. Then another one is a lady named Chris McCann, whose handle is actually, this one's easy. It's Tatsu is Tatsu, but I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
And her work is fantastic. It's like these blurry photos of people with umbrellas, blurry in a good way, like motion blurred and dreamy and very colorful. And I love her work. I mean, it's just, it's really, really cool. And also she has quite a large body of work. Like when you scroll through, there's so many variations on these different themes that she does. So it's kind of abstract. You know, it's a little bit moody, right? It's reminiscent a little bit of like Saul Leiter, but again, she makes it her own. It's not derivative. It's not just like a Saul Leiter wannabe, right? Beautiful work. And she's taken a workshop with me in Tokyo. And honestly, I don't know why she did that because she could probably taught me more stuff than I could have taught her. I don't know, but her work is awesome.
Yeah.
And then number three is another lady named Betty Goh, G-O-H. She's, I want to say from Singapore. Sorry, Betty, if I forgot where you're from. But she's also a great photographer, also quite abstract, but in a different way, much more, not, I don't want to say much more because that sounds like it's better or something. It's just different. It's more like, it's like geometric and dreamy and kind of, you know, but less rain and umbrellas like the previous lady that I mentioned.
Yeah, yeah.
And her work is also just awesome. I love it. I like looking at it. And again, a very big body of work. She has a lot of variety in her images. So she must be shooting a ton, which I appreciate. And she's having an exhibition in Tokyo in May, on May 11th and 12th. So if you publish this before May 11th and 12th and people are listening and you're in Tokyo,
definitely
come check out her exhibition. It's on her Instagram. And then the last one, I did say three, but I just want to reiterate, Lee Chapman, the guy I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
His work is fantastic. Yeah. If you have any interest in Tokyo photography and street photography, Lee's work is just phenomenal and everybody should be aware of it. It needs to be on everybody's radar because it is top notch. So those four.
Incredible. Thank you so much, man. That's perfect. I do have a really small one and it's more for our German audience because it's an app about the weather. And as you know, I'm a landscape photographer and I do have to know about the weather. And the most crucial thing is I do have to know when it's going to rain. And this app is mainly focused on when it's going to rain because the name of the app is Looks Like Rain. And this one is not going to tell you when
I don't know, how's the temperature and stuff like that, obviously, but it's mainly focused on when it's going to rain. You do have some slightly in color changing charts, which are going to tell you precisely when it's going to rain. And this is pretty, pretty accurate, because I've used it for about 2 or 3 weeks now, and most of the time it works. It's using some basic Apple API and stuff like that. So it's using the Apple weather data, but it's completely free and it's really reliable. But you obviously have to check if it's also reliable in your region, in your hometown and stuff like that, because that's a little bit dependent about where you live. So looks like rain, free little app. Yeah, not only suitable for landscape photographers, but also for people who are doing street and stuff like that. So,
oh, totally.
Yeah.
So as a landscape photographer, you want it to rain or you don't want it to rain? Or it depends. Yeah,
it depends. Sometimes it can be really moody. It can be bring some really nice atmosphere. And I'm aware of it when it's going to rain and the next day is going to be cold. It's high chance of fog, which I want to have.
What you want to have. Yeah,
sunny
fog,
days.
I can imagine. Yeah,
sunny days are the best, but foggy mornings are quite a thing. Yeah. So
I see. Interesting. So for street photographers in Tokyo, that's actually going to be a great app, because we all want it to rain. We love it when it rains in Tokyo. If it's raining, you go out at night and you take pictures in the rain with the neon lights, and it's phenomenal.
Incredible.
It's the best time. Best time.
Because of all those reflections and stuff like that?
Yeah, just the everything is, when the city is wet, all the color, it just burns with color. Like the colors become 10 times stronger than without the rain. So rain is a must.
Are you someone who's going out with an umbrella or something like that? Or do you have a weather sealed camera and you don't care, just go out and take the picture?
Yeah, I have a weather sealed camera, but I'm not a weather sealed Lucas, so I do carry an umbrella.
Get you. Perfect. All right, Lucas, that would be the episode for now. I thank you so much. I'm going to play the little outro here I prepared, and it was a pleasure to have you, man.
It was a pleasure. Likewise. Thank you, Florian, for having me.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Anytime. Thank you for being here. Best wishes to Tokyo. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.